dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week on the program, we heard the first part of a talk by Robert Jensen called The Old Future's Gone, Progressive Strategy Amid Cascading Crises, given at a gathering of activists in Vancouver last August. This week, we'll broadcast most of the discussion that followed. In our second hour, we'll continue with our serial reading of Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal. Over the past 5 weeks, the readings have examined in detail how the society we live in was created and how it has resulted in the domination of the many by the few, to the detriment of most people who are deliberately excluded from the most basic level of decision-making. This week, we'll begin a new section that deals with why we put up with it, the mechanisms of social control. So let's get right into it. Here's Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, who recorded the Robert Jensen event, and will introduce the speaker.
You are about to hear a dialogue with Dr. Robert Jensen, author, Texas journalism professor, and well-known commentator. This question and answer period followed a talk titled The Old Future's Gone, Progressive Politics in Cascading Crises and the Struggle for Strategy, delivered in Vancouver, Canada, on August 11, 2008. If you missed that, download the speech as a free MP3 in the speeches section of ecoshock.org or from radioforall.net. Here is Dr. Jensen.
So, you know, as I said, when Denise and I were talking about what I might do here, I kind of pulled this title out of the air because it had always been hovering out there. And I really did just put this together very recently, and I don't make any claims that it's necessarily coherent or compelling. So I actually would like to hear if people think this makes any sense, and if not, what other directions might be possible. Yeah.
For political activists, it's kind of a perennial debate as to how much energy one should expend in the existing political framework. And right now, of course, in the U.S., there's lots of people, should we support Obama? Should we vote for Nader? Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Well, that one I actually think is pretty simple. There's nothing wrong with voting. I vote in every election, you know, in the U.S., but it's a real mistake to imagine at this point that that's a meaningful political act. I've been saying my standard response to the Obama question is this is a historic election that's completely trivial. It's historic because for many of us, I was born in 1958. I never expected to see a person of African descent as a meaningful presidential candidate, meaningful meaning viable in a major party. And in that sense, it's historic. I mean, the United States at one point in my lifetime was an apartheid society, right? It was a society that was on a par with South Africa in terms of its racial ideology. And in that lifetime, we have a person of African descent who may well be, and in fact, unless there's a dramatic shift, will be the next president. And that's not a truly historic moment. It's also trivial because Barack Obama brings with his campaign no commitment to anything that could be called change. And that's why he's the candidate of change, because he has no change on the agenda, right? It's the total of, you know, emptiness of American politics at this point. My stand, you know, I have lots of friends who are liberal Democrats, and I always say, you know, there's nothing wrong with voting for them, but it's like the animals at the zoo. You don't feed them. You don't give them money. You don't give them your time. You don't give them your energy. You go vote for them. I mean, I would rather see Barack Obama president than John McCain. You know, I'd rather see this bottle of water president than John McCain. That's not saying much, right? But the illusion that Barack Obama is somehow a closet radical and he's going to, you know, get elected and then, you know, reshape American politics is truly delusional. It's the same delusion people had about Bill Clinton in 1992, and all that did was pave the way for a more reactionary politics. So on that level, I think it's pretty clear that if one has truly left feminist critical politics, the electoral arena is not the arena to be playing in, right? That there are other places to work. For me, then, it's a question of whether traditional social movements, like building the anti-war movement in the United States, is a meaningful place to put energy, or are there other places in these more community-building exercises? There, again, I don't think I would pretend to know enough to tell people what to do. The anti-war movement, I have long ago stopped contributing significant energy to the formal anti-war movement because I don't think it's going anywhere and I don't think it can go anywhere in the contemporary context. There are other movements I still try to contribute to. But a lot of this is, let's face it, it's a crapshoot. You know, you're working on hunches. The idea that you know, somebody can step back and plot, you know, you should put 72% of your time into the anti-empire movement, 14% into the anti-racist movement, you know, I just don't think that's the way the world works. I know that my gut tells me that at this particular point in my life, when I'm older, I have some resources I can leverage. I want to put those into things that I think would otherwise go unfunded, for instance. And that means reaching out to younger people in my community who have great ideas. You know, in the end, we're all making it up as we go along at this point. And that's part of what I'm trying to argue.
Why did you say you don't see any trajectory in the anti-war movement?
Well, think about it. As I said, we put 10 to 15 million people in the streets worldwide. At this point, a majority of the U.S. population is against the war in some way, whatever that means. And the U.S. anti-war movement is irrelevant. The U.S. anti-war movement can't even impose on the Democratic Party, the allegedly liberal anti-war party, any conditions. Right? I'm not exactly sure why that is. Right? And that's part of it. But I also don't pretend I have a better strategy. You know, it's not that I'm sitting back and saying, well, the United for Peace and Justice, the anti-war umbrella group, doesn't know what they're doing. I don't know what I'm doing. My point is I think the political landscape has changed in a way that what we knew to do based on previous successes, like during the Vietnam War era, simply doesn't matter. They figured out a way to contain mass demonstrations, for instance. So when I'm a simple boy from the prairie. I grew up in North Dakota, right? Very harsh climate. You sort of learn to live simply. And I think when things don't work, you should stop doing them, right? That, to me, makes sense, in part because when you stop doing what doesn't work, you at least create the potential to invent something new. So when I look at the anti-war movement and everything we do, you know, letters to Congress and demonstrations and public, it's not that I've stopped doing all those things. It's just that I don't see a winning strategy. And I don't know what the winning strategy is. And it may be that the combination of corporate control over the political parties, the nature of corporate mass media, and the way all of this interacts means that large-scale political movements like the anti-war movement simply are not going to work, if by work we mean substantially derail imperial enterprises.
I see. We have a complication in Canada because there was a lot of support for the war in Afghanistan because of September 11th. Yeah. And then we had those same demonstrations here in Canada, and we had a lame duck prime minister who was on his way out the door worried about his legacy. Yeah. And so basically people in Canada saw the anti-war movement as having actually pressured the government to avoid going to the war in Iraq, which really wasn't at all on the political agenda, but people believed that those protests in the streets made Canada take a principled stand on the war in Iraq. Now Canada's deeply integrated into the war effort in Iraq, but Canadians think we're not, because they see those popular demonstrations as actually a success, whereas I think what you said about the States is exactly right. We're complicated in Canada. The anti-war movement lost all its force around Iraq because many of the sort of soft-left liberals believed that they actually did something and that their protests actually made Canada not go to Iraq. And even our politicians can't say anything about Iraq. It's just totally off the agenda because they know people don't support it, and it's going to make it harder to fight in Afghanistan if Canadians think we're in Iraq. So it complicated things a lot here in Canada.
Yeah. And let me just say one more thing. You know, a lot of people I knew who were part of that opposition to the run-up of the Iraq War were really depressed and, you know, just despondent and, you know, went into therapy after the war started and, you know, couldn't cope. And it struck me that it wasn't at all surprising that the Bush administration ignored those protests for a simple reason. If you look at the protests that happened during the Vietnam War, they scared people in power. Why did they scare people in power? Because those people recognized that the students, mostly younger people in the streets, were willing to take risks. Now, some of them ended up not really taking very many risks, but the idea was those were people who were risking their privileged place in society, and it was tearing apart the fabric of the United States, and people in power were scared of that. But it was all based on the idea that these young people were going to risk something. I think when the Bush administration and the Democrats in Congress looked at the opposition to the Iraq War, they knew that those people really weren't going to take risks. It was a much older group. It was a predominantly middle-class group. And those people were willing to come out into the streets. But what risks were those people willing to take? I had people tell me that they were afraid to put lawn signs against the war in their yard. And I said, why? And they said, well, my neighbors might get mad. So you have people who were not even willing to risk a tense engagement with a neighbor. Right? That's not a movement. Movements are defined by collections of people willing to take risks for each other. Right? And that doesn't exist in the United States. Now, if all of a sudden that existed, then movement politics around the war would be different. But I think people in power know perfectly well that folks of a certain class and a certain status in the world are going to make their voices heard, but are not going to take risks. And as long as that's the condition, then I don't think that movement is going to go anywhere.
I don't want to trash transnational movements totally, which is, you know, you kind of, let's look at the local, let's go back and create our own garden, you know, a little Candidean, you know, let's go back to Candide. And I'm just not sure that we need to go that far into the local when we think about this. Because we don't, so we can say that February 15th and 14th and that period was unsuccessful in its kind of impact on Bush. But it was a great rehearsal for something, and I think we shouldn't just, cut it off for that point. And I mean, the people I know in Asia who were part of it, in the Philippines and in Japan, who talk about it as a really great experiment that got hatched at the World Social Forum to see if they could do it, and it all happened. And they thought, well, we did this once, we might be able to do it again. So I think that we need to think about that also as one of your experiments that we talk about. And secondly.
Can I respond real quickly?
Yeah.
I don't want to give the impression that I thought that work is irrelevant. In fact, it's just the opposite. I think it's incredibly important, especially when you live in a society like the U.S., which is so insular. Anything that breaks people out of that notion that the world is defined by what we do in the U.S. is crucial. I agree completely. I'm just suggesting that there are other levels at which we have to work. So, yes, I agree. It's not either or. And I think one of the really exciting parts of the last decade or two has been those connections made across boundaries. You know, the work around the WTO in Seattle that John and I were talking yesterday, was sort of undermined by 9/11, and that movement didn't sustain itself in some ways. But those were really exciting developments and really important. So, yeah.
I actually think that Octavia Butler's work, you know, thinking about the future, it's actually better to invoke those who have actually spent their time writing about it and spent kind of that notion of the imagination. And her work on Parable of the Sower, where she constructs L.A. in 2025 as a world without oil, is, I think, where we could begin imagining those conversations.
I agree, and I'll give three book recommendations. One is the author you mentioned, Octavia Butler, who wrote a two-book set called, first one was called The Parable of the Sower, and the second was The Parable of the Talents. The second one, not as good. I actually taught the parable of the sower, which is she's considered a science fiction writer, although she's really not bound by the genre in that way. I taught that book recently to a first-year seminar, 15, 18-year-olds. This is a book about what happens when it all falls apart, and it's very grim. And I took a chance on teaching it, and I thought they're going to hate me. It was the book they loved, right? Because these 18-year-old kids coming from the suburbs of Dallas and Houston have some recognition somewhere that everything they've been taught their whole lives is utter and complete nonsense. And this book spoke to them. It's really powerful. And the hero is an 18-year-old African-American woman who is really just a phenomenal sort of character. So Octavia Butler is one of them. The more grim version of this is Cormac McCarthy's The Road, which I also recommend. It's a phenomenal book. It's being made into a movie that's going to be out soon as well. And then the third one is James Howard Kunstler, who, again, I often find his political analysis lacking. But his analysis of the energy situation in a book called The Long Emergency, if you just ignore the political stuff, is, I think, very compelling and very accessible for people like me who aren't scientists. He also just published a novel called World Made by Hand, which is not a great piece of fiction, but it imagines in a context of upstate New York, a post-oil world when the structures we're talking about have literally fallen apart. And it's not that any one of these is a roadmap to the future, but they do force us to think, what are we going to be doing at that point? And I think they're really fascinating, and they really are imaginative in the positive sense of that. So.
I come from Africa. I was born in Africa, and I saw the West from there. I grew up with European education, glorifying old empire and democracy and so on. Coming here and being here 14 years, one thing is that I look at democracy as much more like a Coca-Cola democracy, where you're just electing between Diet Coke and Classic Coke or Dasani, maybe. But the main thing is that in terms of the power, there is some degree of arrogance in terms of, as you said, there was peaceful demonstration or anti-war demonstration against Vietnam. But one has to give credit to the Vietnamese for fighting the war. Yeah. And today, we may not agree with all the politics, Taliban or all the Iraqi forces. But there is a lot of resistance there, which in some respect, even the anti-war movement has a link to it, that they know the world is supporting them in terms of the war. So we might say that both sides are losing, in a sense, because if you look at the media and the establishment during the Vietnam War, because I was born in 48, you know, where there was no separation between war and warriors. I write a poetry on soldiers in uniform, where we oppose the war, but we support the warriors who kill children or cherry blossoms, I call them. And I see that if you are taking from a global context where you think not yourself as an American, but as a global citizen, where, say, you acknowledge what people from, say, Africa are saying or Asia are saying in relation to the future, that they may not have any idea what the future will, but there is a lot of bonding going on, because the anti-colonial struggles was homegrown, but at the same time there was a strong influence of African American community or Asian community in England. Gandhi, for example, learned more about anti-colonial struggles in England and South Africa. So in the context of the global scenario, there is also these pigs killing each other in terms of the economic crisis in the US, where whether it's Enron or whether it's housing crisis which we're going through. I mean, I know we are in a crisis situation, but at the same time, there is some degree, as you said, the 18-year-old, because I do research on what grandparents and grandchildren are learning. There is still a lot of hope in that group of grandchildren. And grandparents, either they are enjoying the dementia, Yeah. Or they are saying, no, grandchildren, let's support you, whatever you do.
Yeah. Well, let me. There's a lot in what you said, so let me just sort of take off on that last part, because again, it connects to the Obama question. I haven't spent a lot of time critiquing the Obama campaign. There are some leftists in the U.S. who seem to have made it their mission to destroy any belief that Obama is worth voting for, which is fine. But I don't think it's worth that kind of effort. But when people come and say, why aren't you on the Obama bandwagon? He's giving people hope. I always say, well, what is hope? I mean, hope in what? Right? It's not just a question of whether people are hopeful. It's about whether people are hopeful and clear about the nature of the world in which we live. So to give young people hope that the Democratic Party is a meaningful vehicle for social change is not to give people hope, it's to give people a pill. And that pill eventually will wear off. And I think this is one of those questions now about strategy. If, let's say you had, 100 18-year-olds in front of you, do you want to tell some story that will draw the maximal number to you, but that story will be an illusion? Or do you want a story that's consistent with reality that might draw 10 of them? I personally right now would rather have 10. I would rather have 10 young people with the courage to face reality, right, and make that the core of some sort of organizing, than to have 100 who are on board for some sort of unknown abstract version of hope, which inevitably will bottom out, right, because that system is going to bottom out. And that's the kind of question I think we have to ask. I've been talking to several people about Michael Moore, the filmmaker. And every time I would critique Michael Moore's films, because I haven't seen the last one about healthcare, but all the others I think are really quite abysmal. I don't find him funny, but beyond that, I think the analysis underlying his films is really bad. And I would critique the films, and people would say, yeah, but he brings people in. And I said, yes, but brings people in with what kind of analysis? Toward what end? It's not, we don't measure success at this point by numbers. Right? To have a big group that has no coherent analysis and is moving toward no effective political strategy is not a success. Right? And that's the kind of thing I think we have to sort out. And you're talking about the long view. Political movements don't come and go in a moment. They build over time. Right? That's why I like the title of Kunstler's book, The Long Emergency. Right? It recognizes the crisis nature, but also recognizes the long time frame in which we're going to have to deal with it, I think. So, yes, ma'am.
I'd like to say a few things. I think it's very interesting that you, in Houston, Texas, that there, is it Austin? Austin. You're having workers' co-ops. Because, of course, the biggest problem that we face in North America is this terrible red baiting that we've all suffered from for so long, ever since I was born. The idea of leftism, of Marxism, of co-ops, all this kind of stuff, has been, this radical idea which we are now suggesting we must embrace. And in terms of feminist analysis, is the most, I think, powerful thing about feminist analysis is the idea of the narrative. And there is a narrative out there that is being pumped out daily, and there is this narrative that you are articulating and that many of us are, busy working at day by day, this other narrative that says that, social justice movements all over the world for the last however long they have existed, pre-Nazi times in Germany and on to, the Philippines and Nicaragua and all the stuff that we've been doing around here, those are the movements that we've been supporting, and those are the movements that have been standing up against this aggressive capitalist monster that has been, sort of tromping the earth. And the last thing I want to say is that I'm pretty sure that within the corporate sector, within the powerful corporate sector, there is probably a radical arm, because not all of them are wedded to the military-industrial pharmaceutical complex. I think there's probably some very radical corporate types, corporations in and of themselves, that are completely wedded to a view of a much more sustainable, honestly sustainable, not just, sort of pretend sustainable, but they have all their investments in things which we will actually need in the future to a certain extent. And I think that some of them are probably busy having small groups like this too, you know, and speaking to each other in spite of the fact that all their colleagues and everybody that they know maybe doesn't even know that they don't agree with the corporate culture.
Well, there's several thoughts. Number one, I don't want anything I've said to suggest that I think people should stop doing things. I mean, I make a fairly decent living now, and I'm tenured. If I wanted to stay drunk and watch cable TV 24 hours a day, I could do it. Right? I mean, and I spend most of my free time working politically. I think it's where we find meaning.
So I want to
really emphasize that. That's the message is not that there's no hope. It's just I think we work most effectively when we work within a realistic, you know, view of the world. You mentioned the sort of the long history of resistance to capitalism and other hierarchies. I think that's very important. It's very important to tap into it. It's also very important to realize when strategies and rhetoric has to change. So, for instance, I don't ever refer to myself in public as a Marxist, as a socialist, even an anarchist, even though in some ways all of those, you know, historical schools of thought inform what I do. I talk about being anti-capitalist precisely because those other terms don't mean anything in the U.S. right now, or what they mean is so distorted they're useless. I don't hesitate to talk about being against capitalism. I did one of my favorite talks I did was, you know, I think I called it something like anti-capitalism in 10 minutes or less. Right? And all I said is, listen, you can go to ordinary people and you can make three obvious points. Capitalism is inhuman, anti-democratic, and unsustainable. It's inhuman because it's based on a conception of human nature that says we are nothing but self-interested, greedy maximizers, right? Which is true. We are that. We're also compassionate and humane. So you've fashioned a philosophy that tells you that you're the worst kind of person you can be. It's anti-democratic because whatever capitalism is in theory, in practice, it's a wealth-concentrating system. And when you concentrate wealth, you concentrate power. That's not hard to sell to people either. People look around at lobbying and campaign contributions. They say, yeah. And capitalism is unsustainable. It's not the only unsustainable system that's ever been, but it is unsustainable. It's based on a notion of unlimited growth. And look around, it's a finite planet. Right? And if you talk about it in that way, people kind of nod. It doesn't mean they're immediately converted to the left, but there are ways to do this. And it's about constructing a narrative, I agree. It's about telling a certain story of how to understand the world that responds to the reality of the world we live in. The only thing I think I probably disagree with, I don't think there are any radical people in the corporate world because the corporate world is not radical. It's not about the individual people. It's about the nature of the system. And at some point, everybody in the corporate world is going to have to make a decision about how to maximize profit or not. And those people that do not maximize profit will be pushed out. So I think anybody with a real understanding of the nature of the struggle we're in may have a day job in the corporate world. I have lots of friends who have day jobs there. But I don't think the corporate world is a vehicle for any change. It is, in fact, an impediment to them. And I think we do have to verbalize that. And that's important right now because people like Paul Hawken and these folks are running around talking about green capitalism and how the market is going to produce the innovation that get us through the end of cheap oil. I think that's utterly ridiculous. And I think those people have to be denounced. Right? I mean, I like to denounce Paul Hawken whenever I can. It's that sort of technological fundamentalism, market-driven notion. And I don't think there's any historical evidence of that, nor do I think theoretically it's even possible to imagine. Yes, sir?
I would like to connect it with terror. I don't know a lot about the United States. You have given us a picture. You have been there. You know it better than I do. But within the third world context, after 9/11, there is a tendency of stigmatizing popular movements, any popular movement, either it is armed, even opposing any type of a system, is considered as a terrorist movement.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Stigmatized by
the West.
Yeah, okay.
By the West, I mean. And of course, they have local agents too. Mm-hmm. Within our country, too, there are rulers who are supporting. Now, I'll give you, I am originally from Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a side to the case of my own country. The Ethiopian government has a neighbor, that is Somalia. Mm-hmm. And before that, I think it was 1955 or so, there was some fighting between the Somali government and the Ethiopian government, border issue. But after that, they are living, they are coexisting. Mm. But the United States considers Somalia as a place which is harboring Al-Qaeda. Right. Then the regime in Addis Ababa is not popular, and then they were looking for an ally which they can use to achieve their objective. Mm. And once they did, they went and intervened in the affairs of Somalia. They removed a regime which was pacifying the population, because Somalia has been without a state since 1991. And that regime is still there and is being supported by the United States government. Mm-hmm. Then even within the country, anybody who is standing against that regime is considered as a terrorist. Mm-hmm. And the United States government supports that position. That is one point I'm raising. Not only that, now Mahatma Gandhi was waging a peaceful campaign. He was anti-war. He was against violence. But when he was fighting the British government, was considered as a subversive element. Now, by today's definition, a terrorist. But he was an non-violent person. Mandela fought against apartheid, and he was in prison for 27 good years. Yeah. The people who are fighting against apartheid, those who are based locally within the country and the outside, including himself, I think Mrs. Thatcher, defined him as a terrorist. Sure. And even the United States government, it was recently that was in your constitution that he was not allowed, I think, to visit the United States except New York, which is the headquarters of the United Nations. And it was recently that they removed it from the constitution that he could go in. And then under this context, you find it very difficult to operate within the third world context. People who want to move forward, people who like to bring change, who want to democratize, are being stifled. Okay. And for that, the West, especially the United States, is very much responsible. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah. So it reminds us that when we live in the United States or to some degree in Canada, our job is to try to relieve that pressure. Right? And, you know, it's a big job and we're failing at it, but we keep going. And one of the things, to go back to this notion of a narrative, is to never capitulate to the framework that is offered by the mainstream. So I haven't used the word war on terror without the modifier so-called war on terror since 9/11. I never talk about the war on terror. I never talk about whether it's good or bad to fight the war on terror, because it's not a war on terror. Right. For the first reason is terror is a method. Right. It's not an entity. So a war on terror is like having a war on artillery or a war on aerial bombing. You don't go to war against a method of fighting. Right. So it's also not a war on terrorists. It's a war on certain organizations, individuals, and states that do not capitulate to Western domination. And that story has to be told over and over and over again. And it's also connected to never accepting the framework that the United States has simply made mistakes, right? That it's this blundering, benevolent giant that keeps getting things wrong. You know, that it's the story now we tell ourselves about the Vietnam War. Well, we just didn't understand it. It was nationalist, not Cold War. We got all confused. We meant well. This constant, you know, reframing things, not as deliberate acts to dominate strategically crucial regions, but good faith attempts to bring democracy that went wrong. So part of it is, as you're saying, is never being sucked into those frameworks and constantly resisting them and telling another story. And in the West, being willing to say without hesitation that you support, this goes back to your comments here, you support the right of resistance. I do not support the Taliban. I do not support certain elements within Iraq, but it's not my business, you know, to support or not support them. I don't live there. It's my business to support the right of resistance, which is part of international law and basic moral principles. Right? And when it's relevant, if I'm in another part of the world or I'm part of transnational organizing efforts, to support those elements within society that are consistent with my values, which I don't hesitate to do. Right? But to constantly say the right of resistance, and then that bumps up to the support the troops rhetoric. And so you're always going back to try to undermine the fundamental mythology of the culture. In this book, I have some of my books up here, one of which is called Citizens of the Empire. There are chapters taking apart the notion of support the troops, taking apart the notion of patriotism, taking apart the notion that the United States is the greatest nation on earth. Because lots of people who have instincts to resist sometimes get sucked into those narratives. And those are the three big ones. The U.S., it is the greatest nation on earth. That you know, yes?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think I agree with your point, and there's a kind of constant resistance rhetorically that's needed. You were next, sir.
Thank you. I took great pleasure and edification on what you had to say, particularly the focus on the need for a kind of radical humility and skepticism. I'm very proud of my own radical humility. So I really value it. We do need to know that we don't know very much and still keep going. In that spirit, I wanted to offer one comment on one of your analytical pieces and one kind of little technical suggestion for tonight. I really like your triune revolution model, the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, and the delusional revolution. But particularly given how grounded your work is in the feminist critique of pornography and feminist critique of hierarchy, I wonder if it wouldn't make sense to put prior to those three the gender revolution, where patriarchy was invented and men appropriated the labor and the bodies of women and children. I think that's the fundamental template. That's where we learned how to treat others as cattle. Mm-hmm. And that's fundamental to exploitation and hierarchy, as fundamental as exploitation of agriculture. So I think it might weave back into your analysis to do that. And then just on a technical short-term basis, we all nodded with great enthusiasm as you talked about local experiments and small stuff where we live and being open-ended. In that spirit, I wonder if it might make sense to circulate a sign-up list.
Just one comment on the question about patriarchy. I think most folks who've looked at this would say that patriarchy comes out of that agricultural culture, the shift to agriculture, you know, that patriarchy emerges. And I would agree that I think it is the fundamental structuring hierarchy. But I think when one says that, one has to be very clear what you mean by that. That doesn't mean that all situations in which there is a question of gender oppression are fundamentally more important or more dramatic than other ways that oppression plays out. And I think people, I'm not saying you did this, but I'm using it as sort of a platform. People get confused. If you say patriarchy is the fundamental structuring oppression, which I actually believe is true, in some sense it's true just in a technical sense. It's the first of them. You know, modern racism as we understand it is only really the product of the last 500 years or so. Capitalism, depending on how you chart it, is 200-300 years old, right? So in that sense, it's almost logically obvious that patriarchy is the original hierarchy. All that means is that that is the template in a sense. It doesn't mean in any given moment that gender oppression trumps racism in a particular situation, right? I mean, that isn't what we're saying. We're just trying to get a handle on how these things emerge. And I think that's an important one to recognize, because people do then get in this, well, you're saying gender oppression is worse than race oppression. Well, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that at any given moment, those will play out in different ways depending on the conditions you're under. Right.
You must identify the primary contradiction.
Right. But I do think that a lot of movements are, you know, this is sort of the story of the emergence of second wave feminism, when other movements committed to liberation would not take seriously gender. And the other thing about feminism, I think it's important to recognize, at least this is what it was for me. It was not just a way of studying how women get kicked around in the world, right? It was a way of studying how power works. And the way I think about it is that you can, when you want to understand the fundamental nature of power, you can come into that through any number of doors. I happen to walk through the feminist door first. Other people walk through a white supremacy analysis first. There's a capitalist analysis. There's an imperial. All of these are fundamentally ways of seeing the way that hierarchy is naturalized and therefore replicated. Right? And to have a fundamental experience in one of those areas we almost always come into this through one particular experience. For me, it was the anti-porn feminist critique. Right? It doesn't mean then you're locked into that and you can't understand the connections. And in the book I did on pornography, I try to sort of write through that and think through that. And I think those divisions that emerge when people misunderstand what we're trying to say are really tragic. So we have to be very clear on what we mean by that.
Yeah. I have two questions. First is that in Britain, just in early August, there was a mass climate camp to try and bring to the attention of the government that they shouldn't go back to coal. It was their major source of power. And the police took it as an ideal training camp of some kind. There were at one point about 1,500 people in the field, and there were about 1,500 police there, plus the horsemen and so on, and they searched all the bags and violated various rights. They had crayons because they might be used to make sonics from children. So I'm thinking that one of the things that we have to look at in social organizing is now, after 9/11 especially, this militarization of the police, this ready mechanism with new weapons all the time. They're going to use sound machines to disperse crowds or burn your skin from a distance or something. Have little bugs to surveil you in the air. What is your reaction about the role of police now in supporting the unsupportable? We have a system which at the top says we want to change and get rid of carbon, but we're going to open up coal plants, and we're going to use police against you if you organize against that. So that's my first question.
Well, I don't know that I have much to say except to sort of agree that this is a disturbing trend. That, you know, in the my actual academic work was in First Amendment law, freedom of expression, and the United States has carved out a really expansive legal guarantees of freedom of speech and political association. And those are not trivial. I mean, we have better laws than you have in Canada on a lot of things, for instance. It's also true that, for instance, take the right of association, of assembly in public. Right? It's been legally now established that public space is public space. There's no question that you can go into parks and speak. It's also true that police have developed, as you're pointing out, very sophisticated control mechanisms, right? You know, cordoning off people in protest zones, preemptive arrests, things that don't look like the way they went after Vietnam War era demonstrators, for instance, but are much more effective in certain ways. Right? And part of that is the militarization of it, the SWAT teams, the way in which a lot of these global protests, the one I'm thinking of was in Miami, I don't remember how many years ago now, Free Trade Area of the Americas Act, where everybody was shocked at how the Miami police mobilized as a paramilitary operation. It's a reminder that, you know, on the left in critical movements, we figure out how to do things better. You know, we figured out how to use cell phones and everything to organize demos on the run. The cops are learning too, right? And they're learning. They tend to learn at least as fast, if not faster, because they've got better resources and they will always have more guns. And it does raise certain questions. And I raise the questions with no answer to them, right? But they are serious things to consider. What does it mean to have a demonstration in that context, right? Where you're going to be cordoned off out of visibility, and the whole way that it's going to play out means the media is going to construct you in a sort of typically caricatured way. And if you actually get to the point where you're a serious threat, these new mechanisms of crowd control will be employed. You know, how are we going to deal with that? You know, it might be that certain kinds of large-scale demonstrations, for all these reasons, simply are no longer a place to put energy. I don't know. But I do think that when things consistently fail, we have to rethink, and this is part of that rethinking. Did you have another point?
I did. I'll try not to take too long. I was interested in your comments on Paul Hawken. He introduced Adam Werbach, who's gone to work for Walmart, to green Walmart, and they've proclaimed that environmentalism is dead, along with Schellenberger and Nordhaus. Yeah. And so I'm interested, what is your critique of Paul Hawken? Just give us a...
Well, I think there's an unwillingness in certain circles that would be called left, progressive, whatever, to recognize that the game is over, right? This high-energy, high-technology world is over, and it can't go on, the level at which we live is not going to continue. Right? And that's where I start. Now, that's not easy to sell to a public that has become anesthetized on material comfort. Right? And it's not easy for some of the people, I think, that we're talking about to recognize, right? Or they don't want to, or whatever. So all of this notion that either technology or the market is going to solve problems, I think, are just fundamentally inconsistent with reality. Right? The history of technology is that all of the solutions that come through high technology have unintended consequences that are often more dramatic than the original problem. And the idea that you can continually look to failed, you know, technology solutions is inconsistent with reality. And I think the same can be said of the market. So anytime you then construct high technology market-based solutions, what are you constructing? Right? Another one who's big on this is Amory Lovins, who I actually despise more. Right? And all it does is it continues to encourage people. Amory Lovins' big thing is the hypercar. Right? The fundamental problem of the transportation system is the car is an unsustainable mode of transportation. And it doesn't matter how much more efficient you make the car. The car is, it's an artifact of history, right? We just haven't recognized it yet. And so here's Amory Lovins, who's one of the most brilliant technical thinkers probably around today, you know, putting all this energy into the hypercar, right? Which he then goes and sells to various companies trying to get, you know. Those are dead ends, I think. I just don't think they're meaningful. We've got to come to terms with this reality. And anything that takes us away from that is, I think, diversionary. And that's my fundamental problem with that stuff. Right? We just have to start telling the truth. Right? The problem is not just Donald Trump. The problem is this, as Kunstler calls it, living arrangements with no future. Right? Especially in a world in which more and more people, and I'm one of them, I mean, again, I'm a product of the post-World War II, you know, world, this high-energy, high-tech world where, you know, I was raised to think that eating canned vegetables was superior to eating fresh vegetables because that was modern. You know, I mean, I'm a product of this world, and I am struggling myself with how to reconnect to a different sense of the world. And anything that helps people do that, I think, is good.
One thing that struck me when I came from Africa was this issue of ignorance. Because in Africa, ignorance is a burden, knowledge is freedom. But here it seems ignorance is freedom.
Well, let me be clear. When Wes Jackson talks about an ignorance-based worldview, he's not saying do your best to be stupid. Right? He's not saying don't get informed. He's saying that in a lot of the technological and scientific endeavors, we have been, you know, to use a phrase, overdriving our headlights. That we imagine we can control the consequences of things that we cannot. And there's no shortage of examples of these things. Right? The ozone hole, you know, global warming, the internal combustion engine. All of these things are things that we invented and put into the world without an understanding of the consequences of them. So when he talks about ignorance, he's talking about an awareness of the limits of human intelligence, which is not the same thing as being ignorant. In the United States, the problem of ignorance is a kind of willed ignorance, a decision that people make not to know things. And I think that is the primary problem in the United States, that people with education and access to information make a choice not to know things, because to know things, if one retains any sort of moral sensibility, if you know about something that's going on that is inconsistent with your own principles, once you know about it, there is the moral question of why have you not acted. And in the United States, part of this mass-mediated, mass-marketed, mass-medicated world is about allowing people to remain willfully ignorant, right? And that's another level at which we have to combat. And this is where I often find myself, again, in tension, because if you look at things like the movie industry and television and the spectacle sports, all of this industry that is designed to keep people out of touch, right? That has to be resisted. And when you resist that, then you're told you're being elitist and, you know, you've got to understand that it's good to go to the Cubs game every now and then. And it's like, no, I actually think that's part of the problem. And so these tensions work out, too, in organizing. How do you reject that part of the society without doing it in a way that seems to be talking down to ordinary people? How do you make that analysis part of a bigger politics that tries to offer an alternative to the mass mass-mediated, mass-marketed, mass-medicated world. Right? So it's both about critique and construction of alternatives. And I went far afield from your point.
The war was, for example, is still being sold in terms of freedom of women in Afghanistan. Right?
Yeah.
That's part of the...
Well, it's well known, the Bush administration's commitment to the freedom of women in the third world, and I can't imagine what you're talking about. Obviously, Laura Bush said that that's why we're there. So you just need to read more American newspapers, sir, I hate to tell you. Okay.
Yeah. I wonder if you could talk about the relationship between movements for social change and civil society. Because it seems to me that there's a tension there on a number of levels, in that one thing is that there's oftentimes when you have people who are, you know, the usual suspects of activists who show up at the demonstration or the city council meeting, that can be dismissed, but then all of a sudden you have the teacup poodle fanciers, the church ladies, and if they show up, then all of a sudden it's whoa, hey, this is something to pay attention to. But at the same time, there's also a tendency, and I think it's both in terms of what happens with civil society groups that aren't necessarily, that are, you know, where that they're not based on social change, but also on what's reported, that when the community association gets together, it's because they don't want the group home in their neighborhood. When the church people get together, it's because they don't want those queer people marrying, and you know that's bad. And what do we do about that? Because it seems to me that we need to have social society is really important, but that's something that's different from social movement organizing. And what's the relationship there, and what do we do about it?
This will probably be rather incoherent, but it is true in the United States that there has been a breakdown of just any kind of social interaction. It's an increasingly fragmented and isolated world in which you have the capacity, if you have any amount of income and privilege, to basically live in bubbles. And that's bad. It's a bad thing, right? This is the bowling alone phenomenon that Putnam, this social scientist, has charted, the demise of these voluntary associations. At the same time, reconnecting people is of no particular value if it's not in the context, as you're suggesting, of people developing a critique of their own privilege. And getting the American public more organized to support the protection of the so-called American lifestyle is not a good thing. And as you're pointing out, that's a lot of where it goes. Right? So there's a difference between what we can call generally left movements that are based in that sort of internationalist critique and fundamental resistance to hierarchies, and the notion that we just have to get people reconnected to each other. Right? I don't think I have much to say about it, except that, you know, one consistently has to pursue this, and it brings us to one of the problems of organizing today in first world societies. If all of the models that we always point to, right? When you give a talk and people say, well, nothing's possible, and we invoke the civil rights movement and the feminist movement and the labor movement. Those were all, I mean, this is a very obvious point, but those were all movements in which people were motivated to engage in activities for social change that in the end were basically about benefiting themselves. Right? If you're in the labor movement, it's because you're getting kicked around and you need organizing rights. If you're in the civil rights movement, it's because people of African descent are being fundamentally excluded from all segments of society. Right? The feminist movement was about women recognizing their status. Right? How do you organize people in relatively privileged societies to undermine their own privilege? That's what we're talking about doing. How do you go to middle-class people in the United States who at some level know that the empire is what delivers to them, at least in the short term, the material benefits that they have, and say, I want you to work against those? Because that's where I'm organizing. I'm organizing. A friend of mine once said, I was getting ready to leave town, and he said, who are you going to tell to hate themselves this time? Right? If you're male trying to work with feminist movements, if you're white trying to work with anti-racist movements, if you're a U.S. citizen trying to work against the empire, if you're middle class trying to work against capitalism, you're always essentially going to people and say, I want you to undermine your own short-term material self-interest. That's a hard sell. in a certain way. And the only way I know to sell it is to point to the way in which being a person is more than being, you know, connected to your material short-term self-interest. The easiest place I've found to do that is around sexuality with men, because the costs of patriarchy to men, while nothing like the costs of patriarchy to women, are in fact quite tangible, right? And you can make that case. It's a harder case to make, I think, sometimes when you're talking about empire, you're talking about capitalism, and when you're talking about race. But that's the case we have to make, which goes back to this notion of a different narrative about what it means to be a human being. What does it mean to live a good life? It's one of the great old philosophical questions. And everybody, you know, kind of laughs when you ask, what is a good life? You're supposed to deal with that in philosophy 101, and then you're supposed to grow up and ignore it. It is still one of the fundamental questions. And I think part of politics is raising that question in a way that doesn't make it sound like we're in philosophy 101 seminars anymore, right? What does it mean? And that means, and this is where, you know, maybe I'll end. It means being willing to be silly in public, right? By being silly, I mean talking about one's own struggle around these things in a way that other people can recognize. Right? So talking about what it means to struggle against this sort of mass consumption society, talking about what it means to you know, go into a mall, what it feels like, why doesn't that provide for me any, you know, meaning? Talking about all this stuff, I think, is really important. And it does feel kind of risky for two reasons. One is it does make you look kind of silly, and people make fun of me all the time. Luckily, I grew up my whole life being made fun of. I was a, you know, small kid who was a target and bullied. So I'm used to it. So I adapt very well to being made fun of. But, you know, the other thing is it risks saying to people the way you have come to understand your world is wrong. Right? And how do you do that in a way that, again, doesn't sound elitist, that doesn't sound condescending? How do you talk about why the mall is not actually going to meet your needs over the long term without sounding like you're telling people, oh, you like to shop and you're just a loser? Right? Those are the kinds of things I struggle with. But we have to be willing to do it. But we also have to be willing to do it effectively. One of the things I've been really struck by is every time I venture out in public and say things I think are going to alienate people, I look around and I see people nodding, right? And it's almost like this relief that somebody said it out loud, right? That people are struggling with what they know is a fundamentally lunatic system, but they are never in spaces where anybody says it out loud, right? And that's an important thing to do. It's not going to mean that 100% of, in my case, middle-class America is going to flock to movements that are anti-capitalist. But, you know, the goal is not to convert 100% of the population. The goal is to convert people to a movement that can someday make social change. And social change never happens only when 100% of the people decide something needs to change. And that's an important thing to keep in mind, too.
That was Dr. Robert Jensen from the School of Journalism at the University of Texas, Austin, answering questions in Vancouver on August 11, 2008. The Q&A session followed a talk titled The Old Future's Gone, Progressive Politics in Cascading Crises and the Struggle for Strategy. Download that as a free MP3 from the speeches section of ecoshock.org or from radioforall.net. That's radio, the number four, all.net. The evening was recorded for nonprofit radio by Alex Smith. Robert Jensen's latest book is Getting Off, Pornography and the End of Masculinity from South End Press. To find his website, just Google University Texas Robert Jensen. That's spelled J-E-N-S-E-N. Thanks for listening.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.